It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Yesterday, the big statue of Robert E. Lee taken down. And if you've ever been to Richmond and seen how massive this structure was, this monument to treason was, it's a good thing to see it go. And I remember a couple years ago, we went down to Richmond for the Fight for 15 convention. And they had the backdrop at that park. And I remember at the time going, really? Is this the place that you want to have? Because it's the center of the community. It's where everything goes. So naturally, this is the place where you have the space that you have. But to have that as the backdrop, I just remember going, wow, something serious and wrong. Now, this is years ago. It's been dismantled. It's taken away. And good. It's about time that this monstrosity is gone. What's interesting to me, and this is the problem I have in all of this, is remember the Republican Party tells us that they're the party of Lincoln, the person who freed the slaves. Correct. Yet, the party of Lincoln loves Robert E. Lee, and I'm struggling with how you balance this. Now, understand, this is how Republican mind works on every issue. Hang around long enough, they're going to be on all sides of it. Front, back, forward, top, you name it. They're going to be on every side of every issue. Depends on the day. Depends on which way the wind blows or who's paying the salary. But this is one of those you go, hold on, I'm a little confused. A little confused with the whole... Yes, we're the party that ended slavery. We're the party of Abe Lincoln. Honest Abe! But we're also the party of the treasonous traitors who wanted to inculcate the institution of slavery forever. And then, to top this off, to really heighten the ignorance, you have the former guy, Donald Trump, who came out with his little spiel about some weird kind of nonsense about how Abe Lincoln was in negotiations to bring Robert E. Lee to the North to fight because he was a strategic general and he was really bright and never lost a war except for Gettysburg. I'm really, really having a tough time with that. But sadly, this is who the Republican Party has turned into. There really aren't much... in the way of beliefs. It's purely about, you know, whatever off the cuff. I got to win this argument, so I'm going to make stuff up. It's crazy. Just crazy. Now, today, the big news, Joe Biden came out and gave his spiel. Understand, you know, we've had a good number of people in this country vaccinated. They're saying at least about three quarters of the population has had at least one of the vaccine. So what we're really talking about in this country is how do we get the 25% of us? How do we get the people who used to wear the tinfoil hats, the conspiracy? How do we get those folks to go, yeah, we should protect ourselves? How do we get to that? Because according to the CDC, about 177 million people have been fully vaccinated. More than 75% have at least the one shot. Understand, we've had over 650,000 people die of COVID. And right now we're in a span, which is the 7-day average, puts us as high as it's been since March, with 1,500 people dying each and every day. So the president had to come out today and had to say something. Had to. Had to come up with a plan. He's got a 6-point plan. That 6-point plan, pretty simple. You need something aggressive. You need something that's going to move us in a direction, ensure that we're fighting this. Look, got to get the vaccine. Got to get the vaccine to people. Got to vaccinate the unvaccinated. That seems pretty simple. Number one, we got to protect the vaccinated people who have done the right thing. We got to make sure that they're protected. There are ways of doing that. We've got to keep schools open, doing the social distancing, doing the things that we need to do to make sure the kids are safe. Absolutely. That's part of it. But we need to do what works. And as they point, as Biden pointed out, we got to do testing, we got to do the masks, the tracing, the stuff that we know, that we knew from the beginning has worked. If only we did it. Got to do that. And then we got to be proactive, and we got to protect our economy from collapsing, and we got to push for recovery. Sane, smart, things moving forward. We also need to improve our healthcare system for the people who have it. This seems pretty simple to me. There was nothing here major in my view. He said, look, we need to get people vaccinated. Vaccines are free. Everyone can get them, 16 and older. You can get them since April, since I guess it was May, if you were 12 and older. We can get them. But yet there are, as he pointed out, some 80 million people, I guess, that haven't gotten anything, nothing. And they're the ones who are, well, holding back. So now what the president has done, he signed an executive order that says, look, if you want to do work for the federal government, you're going to have to vaccinate your employees. You're going to have, this is where I've been saying from the beginning, capitalism will eventually win. And it's going to be interesting to watch the people who were, pro-capitalism, complain when capitalism does what it does and protect itself. But Biden said, look, if you want to do business with us, this is one of the parameters. Now, they, I guess, have limited, exemptions for if you have a health condition, which, your doctor should deal with, or this religious nonsense. And I'm calling bull on the religious nonsense. I'm tired of that. There's nowhere in the Bible, and I've read it, there's nowhere in the Bible that says thou shalt not get vaccine. Sorry. Now, Biden has also said 17 million healthcare workers going to have to get it. Sorry. You want to work in the healthcare facility? You got to go and you got to protect yourself. You got to make sure that you get what you need to protect yourself, but others as well. And look, if anyone takes Medicare or Medicaid, that's going to fall right under their line. OSHA is now coming out with a rule that's going to say, look, all private sector employees, employers with 100 employees, you're going to have to do it too. Or you're going to have a once a week test to make sure that people aren't bringing things in the workplace. Because as I said from the beginning, you have the right not to get it. You do. You just don't have the right to not get it and get me sick and everybody else. And like I said, capitalism's going to figure this out. We've already seen Tyson Foods, and we've already seen United Airlines. They've got mandates. We've seen some of the other airlines charging higher premiums. There's all kinds of stuff going on that is moving us in that direction. But like I said, we've got to get to a point where you got to do this. It's got to get done. Now, like I said, there's protecting the vaccinated. We've got to help them. Their booster shots coming online. That's a good thing. Help get through it. But on the kid front, I look at the Los Angeles school district, the second largest school district in the country. They're mandating 12 years and older that everyone in the school be vaccinated. The president himself said that, I think he said there's something like 80% of teachers and faculty, they're already vaccinated. And he goes, look, we got to get to the rest of it. And it's my sense, if they don't want to do it, there's the door. You have choice. Because what are we seeing? We're seeing the states that have the lowest vaccination rates. They're the ones who have the highest childhood infection rates. They're the ones who are having, ICU bed shortages. They're the ones who are having lots of problems. And gee, I wonder why that is. It's crazy. It's crazy in the moment that we live in. But like I said, there's an opportunity here to do some of the right things, on the increased testing side. We're going to ramp up production of tests. If there are people who refuse to do it, then we got to test them early, got to test them often, make sure that when they're around everybody else, everyone else is safe. That seems sane, seems rational. Nobody's holding anybody to the ground. Nobody's jabbing them as they're walking by. At the end of the day, got to hold people accountable. It seems pretty interesting to me. Now, I loved the comments from the extreme right. The people who tell us how much they love capitalism. My favorite, I think, was is, you know, that Biden's executive order was akin to making murder legal. And I'm going, I'm missing that. But they're arguing that he can't do this. It can't do that. With federal contracts, you can mandate just about anything. You don't have to take a federal contract. That's your choice thing. Remember how much you love choice? Well, this is it. This is your choice. And what's interesting is it's almost bipartisan because a lot of Republicans are now coming around going, you know, we're not going to get past this and we're going to get blamed for it. This is what I love about how some of the messaging is turning, because some of the Republican leadership's going, wait a second, we're going to get blamed for this, because it's our kooky people. It's the people that we've allowed the loudest voice in our party. It's the Trump kids. And even Trump himself was saying, go get the vaccine, which is really weird. But you got Jim Justice, the governor of former Democratic governor of West Virginia turned Trump Republican, saying, look, you know, the very same people who are carrying cell phones around in their pockets are the ones who are telling you all these crazy ideas and all these crazy conspiracies about chips and nonsense that they're putting into you. Look, we can't get chips to make a car. What makes you think capitalism is going to allow them to put a chip in your arm and not put it in a car that they could sell? But Jim Justice said, look, it works. You got to get it done. It seems sane, rational, and that's probably why it's not going to happen. But like I said, capitalism will take care of this. Capitalism will figure it out, because the moneyed interests are tired of losing money. The moneyed interests are going to make sure that they're protected, because at some point you're going to have people suing each other. At some point we're going to end up in courts. And when you look at United Airlines, who said, you know what, we're not taking the medical waivers, we're not taking anything, we're not taking the religious exemption, you're just gone. Going to be interesting to see how this plays out in the courts, especially the courts that someone like Trump packed. Because, you know, and this is where I'm in this weird kind of world. I know a lot of people who represent workers all around the country. And some of the stories that I'm hearing are, look, capitalism is going to win. The moneyed interest of keeping their workforce safe, keeping their businesses open, that's going to win. And we need to make sure that we push for that. It's not difficult stuff. But I had a listener, and I wanted to read this, because I had a listener send me this writing. I think they found it somewhere online. But it's titled In the End. It's written by this Lauren B. And it's one of these things, and I'm not overly emotional, but I wanted to read some of it, because this is a nurse who, this is the person who comes in after you're dead, after you've died of COVID. And this is what she wrote. Quote, on the day you die from COVID, many things will happen. A colleague and I will enter the room to carefully prepare and clean your body. We will shut off all the IV pumps. We'll turn off the ventilator. We'll silence and turn off the monitor that is screaming at us that something is emergently wrong. We'll remove the breathing tube from your throat. We'll pull out the intravenous lines. We'll remove the arterial line that monitored your dangerously low blood pressure. We'll remove the catheter that drained your bladder and measured as your urine output gradually decreased to nil. In the end, they will leave you in the room and it will be just you and I. The machines will be turned off. The beeping will have stopped. The alarms will be discontinued. The room will be silent for the first time in days. I might have on music. If your family told me what you like to listen to, I've listened to all kinds of music at the end. Classic rock, big band, South American flutes, Chinese ballads, country and western. Today, it was the Beatles. Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. I'll cover your body with a sheet and try to position you so you look as natural as possible. I'll dial the phone number or open the video chat and your family will pop up. They will see you and they'll begin sobbing uncontrollably. They will tell you that they love you. They'll question their God. They will tell you that they don't know how they will go on without you. They will thank you for being a great partner, a great spouse, great child, great friend, great person. They'll put the dog up to the camera so you can see them one more time. Old grudges will be forgiven or put aside. I will be privy to family secrets and skeletons that no one else knows about. I'll never breathe a whisper. Your secrets are safe with me. I will listen silently as they beg and they weep and they plead and grieve. I will close my eyes tightly at the scream that signifies pain so raw and deep that it stings my numb and burned out heart. I will try to hold back tears that gather in my own eyes as I empathize with the pain your family is feeling. I will fail. I will cry silently too. I will wait patiently until their tears have slowed and they have told me that they are ready. I will hang up the phone or shut off the video. I'll sigh to myself as I start to clean up. The bag that your battered body lies in won't be zipped up yet. I know it sounds crazy, but I don't believe in zipping up the bag until I'm ready to leave the room. I can't bring myself to clean your room while you lie there inside a dark, zipped-up bag, ignored because you no longer breathe. So I'll take down the drips. It'll take me a while. You'll have been on a lot of drips, sedation, pain medication, fluid, pressors, anti-anxiety medications, a blood thinner. I'll take them all down and puddle the lines on the floor while I dispose of the excess contents. I'll gather up unopened supplies in the room and begin throwing them in the trash. The new cardiac electrodes that don't need to be placed on a chest that no longer has a beating heart. The pulse oximeter that would read zero if it were attached. The oral care kit that we use to try and prevent you from getting a secondary infection in your lungs. The bags of dialysate that were used in a valiant attempt to preserve your kidneys. The tubing that was attached to the ventilator to breathe for you. The numerous pictures and cards that your family dropped off at the front desk of the hospital for us to hang in your room for encouragement and support. All will go in the trash. Nothing will be salvaged from a COVID room. I'll tidy up many caps that have found their way onto the floor. Caps from IV flushes, caps from medication, caps from IV tubing, caps from respiratory equipment, caps that were opened and discarded so quickly as we worked feverishly that they long had been since forgotten and relegated to the floor. Finally, I will be done cleaning. I will stroke your hair. I will hold your hand. I'll position you so you look comfortable. I will wonder why you didn't get vaccinated. Fear, conspiracy, misinformation, just never got around to it? It doesn't matter now. I'll look into your face one more time. I will zip the bag. I will leave you in the room to be transported to the morgue. You, however, will never leave me. Memories like this are not ever forgotten. Because in the end, on the day you die from COVID, it will be just you and I. Sad reality. Right back. Then workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win.
On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1929. That was the day a mistrial was declared in the case of 16 textile mill unionists in North Carolina. The mistrial sparked 5 days of anti-union vigilante violence. Textile mill workers at Gastonia's Lorry Mill had been on strike since April 1st. They demanded higher wages and shorter work hours, union recognition, and an end to the hated stretch-out system. Soon, textile workers at Bessemer City's American Mill walked off the job in solidarity and joined the National Textile Workers Union. Ella Mae Wiggins was one of the strike leaders at American Mill. She was known for her militancy, but also for organizing black workers into the union. As the strike wore on, mill owners evicted dozens of families from company housing. Wiggins helped set up a tent city. On June 7th, sheriff's deputies attacked strikers who marched to Lorry Mill to call out remaining workers. The police arrived at the tent colony later that evening to disarm them, and Gastonia's police chief wound up dead. Immediately, more than 70 textile union members and leaders were rounded up and arrested. 16 stood trial for the murder of Chief Adderholt. The Anti-Union Committee of 100 smashed up the NTWU headquarters in Gastonia and Bessemer City. They kidnapped, beat, and threatened to kill several union members. the rampage continued as SCAB forces moved on to Charlotte to raid the offices of the International Labor Defense, who had handled the strikers' case. 5 days into the terror, Wiggins was killed on her way to a union solidarity rally. Outrage over her murder forced mill owners to improve conditions and wages, but the fight to organize would continue for years.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Larry Elder, the Republican hopeful in California's recall election, was recently visiting a homeless encampment and kind of it was cut short because somebody pelted him with eggs, I guess. And, you know, while I don't agree with pelting people with eggs, I couldn't help but wonder, and this is maybe just how jaded I've gotten, if Larry Elder was there to see how much space was left. So if in the weird chance that he does become the next governor and they do start throwing people out of their homes because the eviction moratorium goes away, he'll know where they can put them out in the street somewhere. I know that's it's horribly morbid, but it's kind of where my mind went. But I'm hoping recent polling, we don't have like Larry Elder. Can you imagine a California governor like Larry Elder? What's the crazy thoughts that come out of that guy's head? Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, what's possible in California, because it hasn't gotten as much attention as I think as it should. I've asked Jenny Cohen to come talk with us. Jennifer is an election security advocate, writer, attorney, my person to go to whenever I find someone's hit me with a conspiracy of everything's fixed, it's all fraud, it's all bad. She's my expert that I go to. Jennifer, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, I'm glad you invited me on to talk about this. Thank you.
So this is a big deal. I mean, this Newsom could be the third governor recalled. This is kind of a big deal for the country, not just California, because if you get someone like a Larry Elder as governor, what kind of crazy senator would we end up with if something unfortunately happened to someone like Dianne Feinstein?
Well, exactly. I think he's even said that he would appoint someone. He didn't call them crazy, but that was my interpretation. I don't know the word that he used. I'm very worried because with this, with what's happening in Texas, with the assault on women's right to choose abortion, whether to have an abortion, and this sort of, crazy going on around the country, the thought kind of is, well, as long as people like me who live in California or probably New York is similar, that if you live, as long as you stay in a blue state, everything's going to be fine. But the problem is, I don't know that we're safe anywhere because they're coming for everywhere. And they're coming for California. The people who want to turn our country into a theocracy, which is most of the GOP now, and unregulated also. And they're coming for California and they want to turn it into like a Florida or a Texas. And that is really scary, not just for an adult like myself, but you know, I've also got kids, and what kind of a place are they gonna be able to go to grow up and have it not be crazy town?
What kind of place are you leaving behind for your kids? Right. I mean, but the I have to give conservatives credit on a certain level, because they're willing to fight in a place like California where, you know, just several years ago, there was never a chance that they were going to win, you know, a statewide elections or take, you know, many House seats. They fight in the places where they don't win, and they do move the ball. And you have to give them credit for having a lot of money and a lot of, you know, leadership vision to train people and to heavily invest in attacking Democratic strongholds.
I mean, yes and no. I think that a lot of them, the ones that have really moved the ball the furthest, are motivated by factors that I'm glad don't necessarily motivate my party. I mean, religious fanaticism is a huge motivator.
Right.
And a lot of these people are religious fanatics. That is what they are. And there's been this sort of alliance between them and the, the people who want, they call it economic liberty, by which they mean no regulation so that they can just make money at the expense of the greater social good, and even if it means polluting, you know, destroying the earth and all of that. So those two things, extreme greed. I mean, absolutely there's greed among Democrats too, but it's just not on the same level. Objectively, right. I really don't think it is. And certainly their religious fanaticism isn't. And so, yeah, they've got a machine that we actually now need to get more motivated in response to this real threat, because I don't think Democrats realize that in addition to sort of the RNC machine, they've got these nonprofits, supposedly they're nonpartisan, like the Leadership Institute, which actually trains people to be, I don't know whether you would even call them grassroots activists at that point because they're getting training for it, but to train them to go into these, that's what they're doing. They're training people to go to these board meetings, and they train them, school board meetings, for example. But it started long before that. I think they've had this since the 60s, maybe it's the 80s, but long time. And they train them on propaganda, communication. They train them how to use social media. They train them how to create websites. And they probably, I don't know. It's really scary.
Honestly and truthfully, what it is it's, and you go back and you read the 1971 Powell memo. Out of that came the Heritage Foundation, the American Legislative Exchange Council, all of these think tanks, this whole state policy network that sprung up out of that. And out of each of those has sprung up a bunch of these institutes, like you've pointed out, to train grassroots people to spew their kind of rhetoric. And they find them in colleges. They find them in the young Republicans clubs, and they fund them. They pay them. They give them jobs, and they do it well. And you have to give them credit for having. And look, they do all kinds of horrible
really
stuff.
The right word, but they are effective at what they're doing.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is you have to give them credit on a certain level that they have used a game plan that has worked effectively over and over again. And I remember the little snotty guy, Ralph Reed. I remember seeing an interview with him back in the late 80s, early 90s. And he was asked, how did you guys come up with this organizing model? And he pulled out the SWOC handbook, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee handbook, which was basically just stealing old school labor organizing of, talking to people and doing the things that Democrats never do anymore. And for me, this has been one of my pet peeves forever. Democrats got to get back out in the streets, ball up their little digits, and actually fight the fights that Republicans are doing. You don't see anybody defending the school boards, do you?
No, but the other thing I do want to say though, they are effective at sort of information warfare. I don't know whether that's something to give them credit for. I'm not sure they do as well as it might appear. I mean, they're good at cheating, I guess, because gerrymandering is largely how they have managed to make progress. That's not really changing people's minds, but they're good at creating, for example, Turning Point USA is that's Charlie Kirk's organization. And by the way, all these leaders are in the Council for National Policy. I do believe that is kind of the top of the pyramid, even above ALEC. The leaders of ALEC are in the CNP. But in any event, they took down, I don't know if it was hundreds, but at least 100 fake Facebook accounts that were all traced back to Turning Point USA. So they do things like using bots. They pay teenagers to send out their messages, but that is kind of what Russia does. It's like a troll farm. And, I'm not sure if that is really something to be celebrated. What they do is they create, I think, a plausibility for some election wins that are maybe, wouldn't otherwise be plausible. I mean, they do things like they come up, if you're someone like me, who is very concerned that the Democrats are not conducting their due diligence to make sure that there's not literal cheating with the voting machines, for example. They do things like if the polls are in their favor, then they're all about the polls. But if they're not, then suddenly they say they're rigged. And what they do is they create something that is basically creating rigged polls, but they call it unskewed polls or unrigged polls. And it creates a plausibility for their candidate. And so until we really conduct more due diligence and more supervision over this incredibly dangerous political party, the GOP, I'm not prepared to say that a lot of their wins are, some of them obviously are real, probably most of them and everything, but I'm not prepared to give them credit for winning elections. And I'm very concerned, by the way, about this, about the recall for sort of a few reasons. Number one, just assuming even the election is all in the up and up, I am concerned about it because, if you get Larry Elder in there, even legitimately, we're screwed as right. California. Number two, the software to the election management system used in 60% of the state was leaked by a MAGA clerk, Trump supporting clerk in Colorado, because we use the same system in a lot of California. And that is the system that programs the voting machines and compiles the precinct totals for entire counties. So, So the experts are saying, and by the way, I'm not really an election security expert. I study what the election security experts say. And what they say is that this gave bad actors the blueprint to know how to find a way in. And there's apparently always a way in. And so, number one, I'm worried they'll cheat. And then Democrats, you know, won't want to look at it carefully because that would undermine faith in elections, which is what Democrats always do to avoiding due diligence and just making it the GOP doesn't cheat. Or they won't figure out how to do it. Or actually, there's three things. Number one, they cheat to win. Number two, they cheat to create an outcry against Democrats. So they flip votes to make it look like Democrats are cheating. That might even be the easiest, because how many vote flipping ballot touchscreen voting machines would it take to start another insurrection in California? Not many, right? So they could do that fairly easily. Number three, they lose, but they just claim that it's rigged and they're already putting, so they have kind of a win-win-win no matter which way they turn right now. And that's the third narrative is the one they're kind of putting out there right now. So I noticed at least a few months ago, that Mike Lindell, who's, you know, the guy that did the fake symposium for Stop the Steal, is a complete Trump guy. He and a scammer, MyPillow guy, he started saying that he thinks that that Trump really won California, which is absurd. And given the demographics. Right. And then Mike Flynn, who's an incredibly dangerous person, also in the CNP, by the way, Council for National Policy, he chimed in saying, yeah, I think maybe you're onto something there about California. And that to me was like, whoa, they're laying the groundwork. If they lose, they're going to just use that as, you know, to do whatever they'll just use that as a propaganda thing to either have another insurrection or to drive turnout for the next election or just, you know, take all the wind out of the Democrat sails. And the California Secretary of State really, I think, she needs to step up her game on the official audit, because although California is much better than a lot of parts of the country in terms of election integrity and auditing, its audits still kind of suck because the bar is very, very low. And that is out there. It's sort of an objective. There are legitimate problems with California's official audits. The news that is out there, what I'm worried is going to, so she needs to just improve it. The main thing she needs to do is expand the audit to include ballots that arrive after election day, because that'll be a lot of the mail ballots. Right. And those should be audited. It's been a hole that everyone's been talking about, real experts, not, you know, Mike Lindell type of people. And she needs to just plan on doing that. And the experts are saying she should do that. And so far she hasn't. So we don't really have a good defense, no matter which way this goes. If they cheat, we don't have a good audit. If they decide to claim that we cheated, we don't have a good audit to defend against that. And yes,
No, you're right. They've set it up to where they heads they win, tails they lose, they win as well. But yep. This is one of those moments where this isn't new. No one should be surprised by this, because Trump's has been setting this argument up since 2015. There's nothing new in this game plan. My problem is we just haven't figured out how to defend it right. You know, because you got Democrats running around saying 2020 was the most secure election ever in the history of elections. And maybe it was. Nobody's shown me any direct proof that someone flipped votes, but I'm still a little going, you know, who knows? I don't want
down ballot. Well, down ballot, there were 27 House races that were supposed to be toss ups and they all went Republican. Now, yes, it's possible. That's completely legitimate, but for God's sakes, we should be auditing all these races. And I don't know how many years election security experts have been saying this, that you need to have reliable paper trails, number one. And then number two, you need to actually use them. Just having paper, it might have a deterrent effect. All right, that is possible. But unless you really, these people study elections, they know which places look and which places don't. And we don't have a system where even when, as is often the case, there's this massive shift between the polling and the result. And it's almost always, by the way, almost always to the right, meaning it's a red shift. My friend Jonathan Simon coined that phrase. We don't have a system that lets us check when that happens. We only do manual recounts, if at all, as a matter of sort of an automatic thing, if the result is like 0.5% between the two. So which is pretty rare. And also, if somebody were to be changing results, they could change more to avoid that automatic recount. And then it puts it all on a candidate to seek it, to go to court and fight it out. And it's really expensive and it's really protracted. And then the Republicans call them a sore loser, like they did with Al Gore. That was like the one time the Democrats did kind of fight back, and they they made banners that said "Sore Loserman," and so we need this. We need these automatic regular audits, and I don't know what it takes for the Democrats to wake up, but we always need them.
So let me ask you this then, because you know there, I have my Trump supporting friends who always say, well, all the they're all rigged. Do you have any confidence in our electoral system at all?
I don't know how to, I don't think of it exactly that way. I don't know how to say that. I mean, I guess a little, sure. I don't believe in blind faith for elections. And that started largely when I found out that Comey and Jay Johnson and Jim Clapper, the Obama administration, basically spread falsehoods about election security on sort of a core issue. Their big thing was that we didn't have to worry about Russia because voting systems don't connect to the internet. And they had brought out this parade of witnesses who testified under oath, and they were wrong. And they've never, and that's pretty much been established. It's not disputed that they were wrong. It's not all voting systems, but ES&S ballot scanners, which were in, they had started installing around 2015, they put wireless modems in them that connect to the internet. And those people never have, they've never even, they don't dispute they got it wrong. Nobody has asked them about it. Yeah. So we don't really know where they got their misinformation. And I'm not going to believe what our official government party line is. And they're, in some ways, they're giving us no reason to believe them. The FBI official policy is not to tell the public of breach. They leave it to the discretion of the private vendor, which you can imagine not every private vendor is going to want to come out and say if their system, you know, was breached. And they leave it to the discretion, sometimes, I guess, to the county or whatever that was breached. And maybe now they've expanded it to the state. They didn't even used to tell the state about breaches.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I go back to the reality of, we got to go back to paper ballots. Hand-marked
and
paper
audits.
Ballots.
and regular audits.
You got to have something that you can count. I want something that, you know, that the mark is on there. We can count it. You can count it again and again. Because clearly these machines, we've got so much technology. We've complicated things to the point to where, you know, on all sides, there are questions.
And the other thing I do want to say, though, is it's not just paper ballots. Now you have to say, really, either add the hand-marked prefix or say pen and paper instead, because now the vendors came out, especially ES&S came out with touchscreen voting machines that mark your ballot for you. Right. And studies show nobody looks at it. And maybe just more obviously, they can really break down, and that can absolutely switch elections. Smartmatic, which is, by the way, only in Los Angeles County. So when Trump tried to say that they stole the election for him, that was a lie. However, there are touchscreen voting machines had one of the most epic breakdowns ever in 2019. I think it was in 2019. I think that's when their primary was, but maybe it was early 2020, but it was not pandemic related. Everything went down with their in-person voting. And that, imagine if that happened in the California recall, yeah, which is going to largely vote by mail. So it wouldn't probably happen to that extent. That's one of the reasons, separate and apart from the pandemic, that they moved to vote by mail, was because these touch screens that supposedly produce mark your paper ballot for you were such a freaking disaster.
No, I'm with you. I said hand marked paper ballot. That's what I want to see. I want us to return to some bit of that. Give me a piece of paper and a marker, and that's where we go. But Jennifer, yeah, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Lots of information, lots of stuff to digest there. But good stuff. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. As always, it's my pleasure to be on your show.
Thanks so much. Appreciate the time. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Any faith in our electoral system? You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the day that the Boston police went out on strike. The police in Boston had not had a raise for over 6 years. They worked long shifts, sometimes even more than 80 hours a week. The police force was predominantly Irish. Many had served as U.S. soldiers in World War I. Fed up with their working conditions, the police formed a union and joined the American Federation of Labor. Boston's police commissioner, Edwin U. Curtis, refused to recognize the police union and fired 19 police officers for their organizing efforts. In response, the new union voted overwhelmingly to support a walkout. More than 1,100 police officers voted to strike, with only 2 voting no. Across the country, newspapers made dire predictions about the collapse of law and order in Boston. While there was an upsurge in crime due to the lack of police on the streets, the press wildly exaggerated what was happening in the city. Newspapers ran stories about gangs running wild with rioters and communists attacking women, fueling Red Scare fears. The entire labor movement came under attack. Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge declared, quote, "There is no right to strike against public safety by anyone, anywhere, anytime." This hard line against the striking police helped propel him to the national stage and eventually to the Oval Office. The striking policemen were fired and replaced with unemployed World War I veterans. In response to the national outcry over the strike, the American Federation of Labor revoked the charter for other police unions. The Boston police strike is the subject of the page-turner The Given Day by author Dennis Lehane. A fictionalized account of the events surrounding the strike, the novel follows the experiences of one Irish policeman during this tumultuous time.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some interesting news coming out of Alaska, and we're going to be taking a trip to Alaska in about a month. Our good friends at Teamsters Local 959 in Anchorage are going to bring us out to do a speech and meet the guys, and we're going to do a couple of programs from there. Looking forward to what I think is going to be an incredible opportunity to reach out to folks there in Alaska. Looking forward, but the EPA today has restored protections, or is in the process of restoring protections, to Alaska's Bristol Bay. Evidently, a Canadian company wanted to build a giant mine there. They're saying no, probably a bad idea because of all the fish and all the wildlife that are dependent on that area. I think it's a good thing. Fortunately, we'll see if this actually gets stopped. But look, new administration, new president, new outlook, new future, hopeful future. And with this EPA, with folks back in charge, I have some hope again. And they've just evidently come out with ways that climate change are going to hit us, and especially going to hit poor and minority communities. And here to share some thoughts on this most recent piece on climate change by the folks at the EPA, I've asked Bill Hersey to come talk with us. Bill's a past president of Local 2050 of the National Federation of Federal Employees. He's also an executive board person, and our good friend Gary Morton, president of AFGE Council 238. Guys, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. Always happy to support you because you've been a supporter of our movement and making sure we hold people accountable.
And it's something I appreciate you guys coming on and talking to me. Bill, let's start with you. I'm looking at this thing in Alaska going, I'm happy to see that there's an EPA out there actually protecting our environment for a change instead of saying, no, go ahead, rape and pillage.
Yeah, well, that's what we had. That's what we had in the previous 4 years. But hopefully, things are turned around for good this time. This report that you referred to, by the way, is a report of the Office of Air and Radiation. And if people want to go search for that at the Office of Air and Radiation website, it's called the Social Vulnerability Report. They could get access to all the data in that report by going to that site.
Yeah, it's I've looked at it. It's long. It's a lot, which is why that we've brought you guys, the experts, on to come and explain to us exactly what's in this. Because look, the reality is most of us don't have the ability to go read hundreds of pages of very dense scientific kind of language, which is why I defer to people who this was your career. So what are we looking at here? You know, we know climate change is real. We're seeing the effects of these massive storms. Things are getting worse. What are they laying out for us?
Shall I take this, Gary?
Yes, you sir. Yes, sir.
In reading this report, the people who did it set two different possible increases in average temperature of 2 degrees Celsius or 4 degrees Celsius. I'm going to revert now to using degrees Fahrenheit because that's what most folks, other than us science wonks, deal with is Fahrenheit degrees, which is about 4 degrees increase, 4 degrees on average Fahrenheit and 8 degrees Fahrenheit at the higher level. And before getting into the individual effects on people, to set the stage, the geographic effects speak very loudly from this report. At the lower so-called increase in temperature, large areas of the Southwest, the Great Plains from Canada down to Mexico, the Midwest and the Northeast, they're likely to see average temperatures actually 6 to 8 degrees higher, 6 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit higher as an average temperature. So that's the lowest thing, lowest energy, or the lowest temperature aspect of this report. And the people who lived in there are going to be suffering this. The effect on individuals, and the report points out, they looked at four different classifications of folks and to see what their relative risks are of having adverse effects.
Right.
Minorities, which includes Black and African American, Asian Americans, Alaskan and Aleutian Islands people, and Asian and Pacific Islands people, and the and also low income folks and people who have less than a high school diploma. To zero in on this, the Black African American community is 40% higher risk of living in an area from which death is a plausible outcome. They're in the highest risk of extreme temperature and extreme adverse health effects. They're also at about a 34% increase to suffer childhood asthma in their kids.
And the but Bill, that's not new. There's nothing new about that.
Yeah.
This has been, you know, it's going on for decades. So let me go to you, Gary, because you know part of what I hope the EPA is doing is taking the information that Bill has laid out, and I think we understand this viscerally. The rich are positioning themselves that they're going to be okay. The poor are basically screwed and are going to be sacrificed so that the rich can have more. What's the EPA going to do to help move us in a direction that protects some of those most vulnerable folks and those of us in the middle, not making us vulnerable?
Well, I hope, because the mission of the EPA is protect human health and the environment for all Americans. But let's be real that race, wealth, politics, all type of economic factors, education, poor whites, poor blacks, everyone is treated the same based on the economic disparities. And environmental justice program, which is not new. However, we hope during this administration it's more than talk,
right?
Because the definition is environmental justice, fair treatment of all people, regardless of color, race, national origin, dealing with the development, implementation, enforcement of laws, regulations. You know, the objective is to have the same degree of environmental protection and health and protection from the health hazards for every American. It's not happening. Politics get in the middle now of the ability of the EPA to do their job. And I want to turn it over back into scientific integrity. Until Congress enables the employees and the agency to actually do their job, it's just talk.
Right. And that's why I come back to this report, Bill, because this report is kind of a basis of going, look, Houston, we have a problem. I forget who recently called, you know, we're in the moment of code red for humanity. The United Nations called it, we're in a moment of code red for humanity. This report seems to bear that out, no?
Well, yeah, this report and also the sixth assessment report of the International Panel on Climate Change has just come out. And there are things like, we're in a situation where the carbon dioxide levels are now higher than they've been in the last 2 million years. The ocean is heating up at the fastest rate in over 10,000 years. And in order to get this under control, we need our union brothers and sisters across the country, and especially the union brothers and sisters in West Virginia. I know they've got concerns about mining jobs, but there are, hopefully we can get some pressure on the senator from West Virginia and Joe Manchin to buy into this big bill the big infrastructure bill. It's currently at $3.5 trillion, but whatever comes out of that bill has got to have control of climate change as part of it. It absolutely has to have that in there, because without that, humanity is on a fast trail for bad news. And among these minorities, by the way, in the report, the most universal adverse effect you see is loss of labor hours because of increased temperatures. That's across the board in Blacks, Hispanics, and others. The low-income folks, the largest impact on those people is loss of labor hours. I mean, obviously, death and childhood asthma is a problem, but they all suffer loss of labor hours because of increased temperature. So this is something for all working people to get hold of, because that's a big deal.
No, it is a big deal. And this is where you go back to what Rex Tillerson said years ago, that, you know, climate change is real, but we're going to adapt. We're going to have new technologies, going to do all this stuff. I never believed that argument, that we were going to be able to adapt and come up with new gadgets and whatnots. And, you know, maybe if they sell us air and charge us more for electricity, for air conditioning, maybe that's the future. And maybe that's the capitalist dream of where we're going. But I'm looking at this and I'm going, all of us are going to be affected adversely in this, and all of us are screwed. So, you know, I looked at this report and I'm going, yeah, it's going to affect minority communities the hardest first. They're the canaries in the coal mine. But eventually it's going to come eat all of us, Gary. And this is one of those moments where you go, when the sinking ship, we can't be dividing ourselves up because we're all going down.
Yes. And climate change is a health issue, and that's why it affects everybody. No matter where you live, it's going to come. I use the analogy, at one time the opium epidemic wasn't declared an epidemic until it hit certain areas, and then it's an epidemic. People have to call their congressmen. Education in terms of just knowledge. Historically, the poor Blacks, poor whites, undereducated, have been forced into a zoned area of development, industrial corridors, freeways, dense population, until they look to repair those areas. And the problem is the economics. There's no economics involved in repairing those areas in terms of helping the people. So again, I've often said, you can't do environmental protection based on economics. And it's a terrible balance, because you have health. And the agency that's invested and supposed to protect human health and the environment is going through hopefully a turn back. But I'm looking at the swiftness of the regulations from the last administration and the lack of swiftness from this administration to reverse some critical areas.
No, this was something I wanted to get into because the administration has talked about some climate issues. They've talked about in this infrastructure plan addressing some of it. I don't think enough. I don't think quickly enough. In fact, you know, President Biden, the administration has said by 2050, we're going to increase our solar capacity to some bit. I'm going, well, we should be doing that now.
Yes.
Is this administration moving fast enough in your estimation? And if not, where could they do better? And what suggestions would you have? Let's start with you, Bill. What could this administration do better?
Let me point out something going way back to the Clinton era when we had a National Partnership Council and all the labor unions at EPA, at the AFTRA units, the NTEU units, NAIL and engineers and scientists, all got together and put heat on administration to do things, including we wrote a letter to the administrator kicking him in the butt about taking action on climate change. We did that back in about 2002. So the unions can stand up again and come together and continue to put pressure on the administration when they work together like that from the inside, and you galvanized unions on the outside to put this kind of pressure in place. I think the pressure on the inside and the pressure on the outside can maybe have some effect. We found that to be the case in a number of issues. There's a EPA union history website that chronicles all of this stuff. And it's the workers inside EPA have more power than they think. I'm afraid they've kind of fallen away from that realization. But if they stand up on their hind legs like we used to do back in the early 2000s, we can make things happen.
Yeah, we got a lot of work to do. Gary, let me ask you, because, you know, at the end of this, I don't think anything gets done until we can figure out how to make it somewhat profitable for someone or we can build an economy around it. Do you see a future in green energy in this country, given the fact that the oil interests and the gas interests have such a stranglehold on our political process?
Yeah, I look at it as maybe a rival league. Yes, there is room for green energy. But as long as we have the political influences, the economical influence, the lobbyists, senators and congressmen who will vote in terms of politics or economics versus health, protecting human health and the environment, the agency needs to be forced to do its job. Can't get caught up in political issues. Scientific integrity is a big problem. Fear of reprisals for speaking out. We just came from administration. They need to make the employees comfortable and also educate the public to demand environmental protection. Environmental protection is not waiting for something to happen. It's a deterrent so it doesn't happen.
Right. No, absolutely. You've got to be much more proactive. And look, one of the things the last administration did really well, and I'm not giving them credit, I'm just saying they did really well, is they neutered your ability to be proactive.
Yes.
And it's this administration's responsibility to pick that mantle up, to move forward, and to undo much of the damage of the last administration. But guys, I appreciate you taking a little time for me. This is really an important topic, and I'm sure something that I'll be reaching out to you again as this continues, because clearly from this report, this isn't going away.
No, I just want to say thank you, Rick, and we're available anytime, because at AFGE Council 238, we want to protect human health and the environment.
Good stuff, guys.
I'd urge people to go to epaunionhistory.org and see how we did it in the past. And as my dad, the longshoreman, used to say, the bosses don't give you anything. You have to stand up and fight for it.
There you go, Bill. Thanks so much. Gary, appreciate the time. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We are.